Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ellen Page.
And I'm Diablo Cody.
And you're listening to Film Spotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
The way that you work, or the way that you don't work, you're not even worth state tuition, Christine.
My name is Lady Bird.
Well, actually, it's not, and it's ridiculous.
Call me Lady Bird like you said you would.
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail, and then back to City College, and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up.
City College, then jail. Wasn't that your path too, Josh?
Come on. You know this. Troll Nation. I'm a member of Troll Nation, remember? Trinity
so you
Christian
did.
College,
yeah, you made it
Trinity
to college.
Trolls. I made it.
The great Laurie Metcalf with Saoirse Ronan in that clip from Lady Bird, actress Greta Gerwig's first film as a director. A lot of love out there for this movie, Josh.
We've got our own review of Gerwig's Lady Bird, and for this week's Top 5, we're going to talk about some of our favorite female-directed debuts.
All that plus Josh's thoughts on Justice League and more.
A little soggy.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Last week, Josh, you shamed me by catching up with Todd Haynes' Wonderstruck and Yorgos Lanthimos' Killing of a Sacred Deer before I had a chance to see either of them. This week, it's Justice League.
I just want to make sure you're clear on a few things. First of all, that boycott of the superhero movies, the Disney Marvel movies that was going on about 10 days ago, that's over. We're not boycotting Disney product anymore. Secondly, this wouldn't have applied. It's a DC movie, Adam. So what's your excuse?
Timing. Just bad timing, Josh, or fortuitous timing, perhaps. While
we'll
you were seeing Justice League, I was seeing Lady Bird. We will get to that in a moment, and we will get to your thoughts on Justice League. I can't wait to hear about all those night battle scenes that sound like they had a lot of rain.
There's some underwater ones, too.
Ooh, of course, Aquaman.
There you go.
Okay, we will look forward to that. And even though I was derelict in my duties last week, I did make up for it a little bit. Not that anyone cares at this point, but I managed to see Wonderstruck, and I'll share my reaction to that. And I did go see Murder on the Orient Express.
Priorities.
It's all
Glad
about priorities.
They're straight with you.
Of course, all that and our top five female directed debuts.
But first, for her directing debut, actress Greta Gerwig cast Laurie Metcalf and Saoirse Ronan as the strong-willed mother-daughter in her autobiographical coming-of-age tale, Lady Bird.
Lady Bird, is that your given name?
Yeah.
Why is it in quotes?
I gave it to myself. It's given to me by me.
Lady Bird always says that she lives on the wrong side of the tracks, but I always thought that that was like a metaphor. But there are actual train tracks.
What you do is very baller. It's very anarchist.
Put the magazine back!
She has a big heart, your mom.
She's warm, but she's also kind of scary.
You can't be scary and warm.
I think you can. Your mom is.
So, you're not interested in any Catholic colleges?
No way. I want schools like Yale, but not Yale because I probably couldn't get in.
You definitely couldn't get in.
I did just come from Lady Bird, Josh, so we are going to jump right into the discussion and your thoughts on the directing debut of Greta Gerwig. As you said, it's autobiographical, at least semi-autobiographical. It takes place in 2002, around the time that Gerwig herself was a teenager, about ready to head off to college in Sacramento. Here she is played by Saoirse Ronan, and I'm sure we will talk about this. There are indisputably parts of the film where she's not only channeling Gerwig in terms of her vocal patterns and some of her physicality, there are some scenes, I think, where it's downright uncanny how much she resembles Gerwig. She plays the title character, Lady Bird. Her name is really Christine, she prefers to be called Lady Bird. And immediately when we meet her, I was reminded of the famous line from Frances Ha, Greta Gerwig playing that character, where she says in the movie, "I'm not a real person yet." She apologizes for not being a real person yet. And that was funny then because she's in her late 20s in that film. Here, it applies to Lady Bird as well. She's trying to figure out who she is, but she's 17, so it's a little bit more forgivable. She has dreams of not staying in California for college, but going off to the East Coast, maybe New York or New Hampshire or even Connecticut. And the movie is about her struggle to achieve that in addition to dealing with her loving but overbearing mom, played by Laurie Metcalf. We've said this a couple times over the past few weeks. This is a movie that is getting a ton of love. I knew that it was almost universally adored. It turns out, no, it's universally adored. 100% on Rotten Tomatoes out of 116 reviews. Our friend Michael Phillips, our friend and frequent contributor here on the show, said in a tweet that it was his favorite American film since Moonlight. So that is certainly high praise. And it prompts me to do something, Josh, that goes against the very spirit of film spotting. Going back to the earliest days of these conversations, I'm going to ask you to be mean. I'm going to dare you to be mean about Lady Bird. Give me something that isn't great about this film, something that should not be adored about Greta Gerwig's debut.
I'm not allowed to do that. Haven't you read my contract? Sam specifically put in there, you start with something positive. So no, I'll
this movie demands it.
You. Can I contradict you at least?
Go for it.
On one thing, I didn't find her to be as much of a Gerwig stand-in. Maybe she's more of the actual Gerwig stand-in, but there was some sharp contrast to many of the Gerwig characters
She makes it her own.
Yeah, she makes it her own, but I even mean the character. Like, I would describe a lot of, whether it's Frances or Brooke from Mistress America, mm-hmm. Brooke's a little more put together than Frances, but they're both kind of daffy, right? They're a little – I mean, Lady Bird is – whip smart. If anything, her problem is that she's too smart for her own good, mm-hmm. right? She sees her circumstances, considers herself above them, whether it's at school or her family. Mm-hmm. And this is a very teen thing. But she has her eyes set on something more. She's whip smart with the dialogue that she delivers, the one-liners. And so, yes, of course, there are elements of those characters. I think the searching to define yourself as your own person is definitely something she shares in common with Frances Ha. I also thought of Nadine, the heroine of The Edge of 17 from last year, a film we both liked quite a bit. Those are both teenage girls who are trying as many provocative things as they can in a way to define themselves based on people's reactions, right? They wait to see.
Wow, I have a note just like that.
Yeah. That's what I thought as I was mm-hmm. watching her. She's testing everyone. She's testing her mom. She's testing her friends. She's testing the teachers. That's what the pink hair is a little bit about.
Right.
You can look in her bedroom and on the wall, she scrawled all these little personal statements. She's actually trying to write out on her wall who she is. And I think that speaks to another great thing about this film is the specificity. Whether everything is drawn from Gerwig's own experience or not, it really doesn't matter because it feels like mm-hmm. it is the life of someone who existed and went through this. You mentioned 2002. The reason that's worth pointing out is because it does play a crucial role, right? The music, some of the clothing styles, and that just sets it in this specific place. So even though it's exploring things that teen movies, you know, mostly have mm-hmm. been male-focused teen movies, have been exploring other movies that do this from a female perspective. But these teen years have been well explored in the movies. This is fresh because it's so specific.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny as well. I think this is where we see Gerwig's touch absolutely is that even when she was playing those goofball characters, she was so precise in her comic timing as an actor. And she brings that to this film. I mean, this is a comically clockwork film.
Yes.
I think a lot of that, maybe we'll get to, has to do, yes, with the performances, but also the editing. We should mention the editor here, Nick Hoy. I'm probably mispronouncing that, H-O-U-Y. But he and Gerwig construct these scenes to get the most laughs out of them and in unique ways using montage. So this was just a delight. Maybe I have some quibbles. Maybe it's on the edge right now for my top 10 list for a few reasons.
You're insane.
We'll get to them. We'll get to them.
Well, you just undercut everything you said positive about this movie.
Is this a perfect movie? I mean, No.
I'll give you the only thing I can quibble with.
All right.
Because I will actually answer my own question since you chose not to. This movie is so specific and so authentic and feels so honest and right and is genuinely funny and heartwarming, but also challenging in certain ways, that when you have a scene, an incredibly minor scene, like one where we meet the new drama instructor, this is at a Catholic school, the boys and girls schools coming together, and we've seen earlier that they were involved in a production of Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along,
Which I learned from Michael Phillips' review, actually.
Okay.
He would identify that.
Well, I get the appropriateness of that because I watched the documentary that I think is still on Netflix this year, Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened, that's all about that failed production. And so I knew that that's a play that's all about the kind of dashed idealism of youth and the disappointment of adulthood. And it makes sense that that's what they're performing in this movie. But they've had this great experience producing this play. And you talk about authenticity, it's a legit production. And you can see the care and the amount of detail and the attention to detail that went into that production. I really enjoyed all of those scenes. They had a great brother who was leading them as their director, and then he gets replaced. We do understand that it may be because of some emotional issues that he's having. That's a really small section of this film. But the new guy is like the assistant varsity football coach or something.
Yeah, football.
So he doesn't know how to do anything except to basically draw up plays. He knows nothing about drama. And the joke for about 30 seconds or 60 seconds was pretty funny.
Yeah.
And then it kind of played out. And it wasn't that it's a bad performance, but it just plays out the way the jokey version, the broad version of that character in that type of movie would be done. So it stands out. It stands out as the only moment like that tonally that just doesn't completely work in the film. Otherwise, Josh, I've got nothing negative I could say about this film. I adored it way beyond my expectations. And I think maybe that was helped by the fact that despite the fact that I knew how people were generally responding to it, I really managed to avoid everything about it. So I had no idea what it was really going to deal with, what type of character Ronan would be playing, what the movie was fundamentally about. I had no idea. So I felt like I was constantly being surprised by the film. And one of my immediate thoughts as I walked out was, how can Gerwig be this good of a writer and director this quickly? It's really not fair when you also add to the fact that she's a fantastic actress. And we could get into the finer points of how much Ronan's performance is or isn't like Gerwig. There are just a couple of scenes. The audition scene where she appears on stage with her hair back and she's wearing an outfit that seems just like the type of outfit we've seen Gerwig wear so many times. I felt like, oh my goodness, that must have been Gerwig at 17. That is exactly how she looked.
What does the nun say about her? At one point, you have a performative streak.
You have a performative streak.
So sure, that seems to fit, absolutely.
And she agrees with that. But I love what you said about her general provocativeness and the types of responses it seems that she's trying to get from people, because she does burn with such an intensity that makes her immediately an interesting character to me. And I think where I noticed it, or where it really struck me the most, is when she sees the guy she's developing some feelings for, Lucas Hedges from Manchester by the Sea, playing a very different character than that character. And he is wonderful here in this film. And she sees him after developing a little bit of a crush on him in the auditions. She then sees him at the grocery store and goes up and just starts hitting him with questions with this laser-like focus. And it was almost, Josh, like she's someone who's from another planet. And the way she talks to people and the way she listens, it's as if she's studying you. That response, what you say and how you say it, is way more interesting to her than anything she might be saying. So there is this inherent provocation in almost everything she does that could seem calculated, but actually doesn't come off that way at all. It's just an eagerness, this desire to constantly be expanding somehow.
I think those scenes with the drama group are where the movie really hits its comic stride. I mean, it's funny throughout, but there you get a sense of, you're right, this is a well thought out and put together production, but it's a high school production, so it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. And the movie hits that nice balance of honoring the kid's effort and in some cases genuine talent. I think that's why she falls for the Lucas Hedges character, right? Because he knocks his audition out of the park and she immediately swoons. I love that touch. But there's also the recognition that, hey, these are kids. They're not all talented. Mm-hmm. And yet it never falls into making fun of them. You know? And this movie has a sense of – it's in love with these characters' foibles as much as the things that they're inherently good at mm-hmm. or likable about. It loves the fact that they're imperfect, and it's rooting for them to maybe move beyond those things in certain cases or learn to live with that imperfection in other cases. There's just this sense that it recognizes everyone here is – they're clumsy because they're trying to express themselves.
Right.
They're not clumsy because they're inherently mean or stupid or untalented. Mm-hmm. They're just in this awkward age where they're trying to get their true selves out there in the world, and that's going to be laughable at times. But it's a very gentle laughter. It's an understanding laughter, and I think that's what makes this such an enjoyable movie to see with a crowd too. I don't know if your theater happened to be full at all, but ours was packed and people were just – they were with this thing from the beginning.
Were you at a critic screening?
Yeah, it was a screen. Well, it was one of the evening ones where it was, you know, open to the public as well. But that's where they had it for critics, and it was a full house and people were just, you know, laughing along the whole time. And that made this a lot of fun too. And I want to get back to the – you know, the ways this movie is funny beyond the performances. I mentioned the editing and the montages I was talking about. The one I'll point out is, let's just say there's a kiss of betrayal that's revealed. Maybe this is about halfway through. And Gerwig moves so quickly from that. The next cut is Lady Bird and a friend in tears because she's been betrayed, listening to Dave Matthews Band. Uh-huh. There's another detail, you know, perfect song for that. And then another quick cut after a few seconds to her elation at getting her cast that's been on her arm for this first half of the movie taken off.
Right.
And I have to think there was maybe 10 seconds we go from those three things. And I just love the speed of it. I love that it respects the audience to keep up. And it makes each of those – just cutting from one to the other makes each of those funny in their own way. And it also mimics – the speed at which your emotions go at that age, right? It's putting us right in that headspace where the jokes here come – the comedy fires as fast as its characters' hormones. And that's one of the other enjoyable things about this movie.
Well, even the scene where we see how she gets the cast on her arm or the act that causes it is hilarious and is a great moment that's all made from the editing.
That's also an example of an abrupt cut mm-hmm. used for comic effect.
Yeah, and Lady Bird as a character, she's so determined to broaden her horizons, to expand, as we said, to sort of become this edgy, what she hopes will be this fascinating version of herself, that we see her throughout the film be willing, moment to moment, to become this kind of Zelig-like character, where she will morph into whoever she thinks the people around her want her to be. Again, gets back to that idea of kind of just discovering who you really are and also being provocative and seeing what sticks and what doesn't. And there really is, if you think about it, a lot of pretend going on in this film, a lot of performance, right? Not only in her character name, what she chooses to give herself, but also in the plays that we talked about. And even there's a moment later where mother and daughter go on a little excursion to make themselves feel better that is completely about performance. So that is a theme and a layer that runs through this entire film. And one of the things that does come to light, I think, is that the movie does on some level become a love letter, I suppose, to Sacramento, to the city that we've seen this character throughout just rip on and want nothing more than to escape. She seems to hate everything about it. But more than that, it's a love letter to the people, as you said, who are not there just to be laughed at, though we often are laughing at them and with them, but her parents, her friends, the people that run her school, the authority figures, she treats so many of them with hostility and disregard without ever realizing until maybe by the end of the film just how much support she has, that she can only be that character, that performative character, because of the constant leash she's being given. Even when she blatantly screws up, somehow these characters are there to still find room in their hearts to forgive her and to let her continue to make those mistakes. And how many films do we see about characters where the parents and the authority figures and others around them don't allow kids that type of freedom?
Probably the most complicated example of that is her relationship with her mother, Marion, played mm-hmm. by Laurie Metcalf. I think Metcalf gives an astonishing performance in what is really, you know, could have been a really unlikable character, the heavy, the villain.
Because
she's horribly passive aggressive to Lady Bird. Yes, she's giving her that leash. You know, she lets her dye her hair, but how about the scene where she's counting the towels she uses? And that's where she's going to enforce her control of her, right? And that's just such a heartbreaking scene because you see the bond between them crack a little bit when she confronts her that way. And I think Metcalf is just wonderful in that she also allows little smiles of exasperation, sad smiles, to be almost the first way she looks at Lady Bird after one of her outbursts or after she says something. So there,
that's true,
there's
yeah.
just enough hint that there's real, there's a bedrock of love there.
Sure.
Underneath the exasperation. But she's also, Metcalf also isn't afraid to really hone in on that passive aggressiveness. And I think that's what makes the dynamic between them so true. That great scene, which is in the trailer where they're shopping for dresses at the thrift store, and they're really going at each other. It's same argument. They always have another variation. And they see a dress they both like and instantly snap out of it
right.
and start oohing and aahing together. And packaging that all in one is just, again, it's specificity. It's a small snapshot of a specific moment that somehow captures their entire complicated relationship.
That's it. And one character in the movie does describe the mother as scary. And when Lady Bird tries to counter and say, no, she's actually very warm and loving. And it's the Lucas Hedges character who says, I don't think of her that way at all. You can't be both of those things. But Metcalf manages to be both of those things in this film. Everything you said about her and her performance is true in that she doesn't hold back. And yet it seems to me very restrained in that we do see in her reason and rationality and love. Yes, she goes too far sometimes. There are moments where she does become so passive aggressive with the towel line or one of those moments where she says something really cutting to her in the shop, but she never overdoes it. This isn't a mommy dearest type scenario. There is always some love and there is always vulnerability underneath everything that she is doing. And we understand where she's coming from, just as much as we understand why Lady Bird is reacting the way she is to those moments. And among the many things Gerwig does right here, and Ronan, too, I don't know if we've praised enough for her performance. I think it's truly remarkable, but Gerwig makes all the primary characters here whole and human and gives them those vulnerable moments. You could even argue that the assistant varsity football coach gets a little bit of a redemption later in the film. But there are so many movies where those characters, the brother, the girlfriend of the brother, the father, and the overbearing mother here, the dad, Tracy Letts, we have to give a shout out to the great duo from Steppenwolf here in Chicago, Letts and Metcalf. They all are more than the sum of their deficiencies.
Man, you talk about Letts, and he is so good here because the trailer plays him off as a type we've seen, and it is funny, sort of the little bit out of touch dad in the background. This movie gives us a very real reason why he's like that.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly moving, and both his predicament and Marion, the mother's, they both have a vulnerability that's also rooted in class, which is something that this film is very interested in. Lady Bird's, most of her classmates live in the richer part of town. She's going to a private school. The parents can barely afford it, but all of her classmates, it's just, you know, this is what they do. They live in bigger houses. She, as her boyfriend observes at one point, she's literally lives on the other side of the tracks. And man, does that come into play? You mentioned that outing, that excursion that she and her mother go on. They're pretend house shopping.
Yeah.
So they leave their little dumpy ranch and go to these mansions on a weekend or wherever it is, these open houses, and pretend like they're shopping for homes. And there's something, again, it's a moment of bonding between them, which is sweet, but the bittersweet side is that it speaks to not only her parents' vulnerability and insecurities and why they treat her that way and are driving her to get her act together, but really it's the same reason why she wants out of there, right?
Yeah.
She sees these schools in the East as not only – it's aspirational not only intellectually in her mind, but really also economically. I think she sees this vision of herself where she's going to get one of those big houses. She just has to go across the country to get it.
Right. And that moment where they bond during that trip, I think, comes down to the fact that it's the one time, I think the one time in the whole film where we see the mother character embrace fantasy. She's otherwise the ultimate pragmatist.
Yeah.
Pragmatist on levels I didn't think were really possible, especially as we think back to the towel scene where she's calculating how many towels will be dirty, necessitating her to do wash before she goes to work. She's always about the reality of their situation, and she never allows herself to get lost in fantasy. And all Lady Bird wants to do is to get lost in fantasy and to play pretend. And that reminds me of one of my other favorite lines in the film where Lady Bird is talking to a college counselor, and she says, part of my job is to be realistic with you. And Lady Bird replies, that seems to be everyone's job, or something along those yeah. lines. As a kid, at that age, maybe we, Josh, I don't know, I don't want to speak for you, maybe we were a little more level-headed and not quite as fanciful as Lady Bird, but all you want to do is break out or believe that you can break out in some way and buy into these myths about the world and what you can accomplish. Allow your heart to even be broken. Allow yourself to fail. And what the movie did really make me realize, especially as we both have kids approaching the age of Lady Bird, it hit me pretty hard. All we do as parents, and our hearts are in the right place, is try to prevent that. Try to prevent that heartbreak and the failure, even as we resisted our parents' efforts to do just the same, like Mad, when we were young ourselves.
Yeah, it's really dispiriting to be watching more and more of these movies and recognizing the parents more than the kids.
I know.
You know, that's happening more
it's
and
so
more,
true.
I'm afraid. But, you know, okay, so I'll give you a quibble. Since you shared a quibble, I'll give you a quibble for me. I was surprised, and this isn't necessarily bad, but given how open the majority of the movie is to awkwardness and unease, it did surprise me that a couple of strings are tied up pretty neatly at the end here. There's a little bit more wish fulfillment than I would have expected. I don't think it's out of nowhere, and certainly I was happy to have it because you're rooting for her and all these relationships she has the entire movie. So I'm happy to see those things come together. But it did strike me as maybe, I don't know, in the screenplay process or something, an attempt to really bring things together quickly at the end. But I will say the final moments are just about perfect.
Yeah.
And also rely again on another, you know, nice bit of editing to not let a moment hang any longer than it should.
Yeah, it's hard. I can't really refute you even as I want to, simply because I would then be spoiling parts of the movie that I'm not going to spoil. But I don't really agree. I mean, I do agree that there is an impulse here to have some conflicts resolve and for certain characters to have epiphanies, albeit fairly minor ones. But I think in every one of those cases, we could point to ways that Gerwig undercuts those moments in ways that less honest movies, truly conventional movies, wouldn't be brave enough to do.
Yeah, it doesn't get like schmaltzy or sentimental at all.
No, in fact, it kind of destroyed me, honestly. The last 15 minutes of this film really knocked me out. So Lady Bird is out now in limited release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Will Lady Bird make either of our lists of the best female-directed debuts? The Film Spotting Top 5 is ahead. Next, though, we'll reveal Thor's secret identity from our last installment of Massacre Theater and play another round of everyone's favorite film spotting game. Stay with us.
After the death of the Superman.
And where is the Gotham Bat? The mass vigilante has been a no-show.
They said the Age of Heroes would never come again.
It has to.
A clip there from the trailer for Justice League, and Josh, always one step ahead of me. You caught this one right before joining me here in the studio. From the clip, we can surmise the general plot of the new Zack Snyder-directed film, Superman Has Died. Sorry, spoiler if you haven't seen Batman v. Superman. Ben Affleck's Dark Knight teams up with Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman and others to confront what I'm told is an even greater enemy. Even greater than whom, Josh? And should I care?
Even greater than whom? Okay, you're really making me think back now. Lex Luthor was in the last one.
That's right.
Okay, Jesse Eisenberg. I believe he also had like a space troll he unleashed on them.
Space troll.
This has a space demon bad guy. It's one of these all powerful.
Dark Side, is that his name?
No. Steppenwolf is his name.
Really?
Yeah. Did I just make that up?
No, you're probably right. I thought it was Dark Side.
No, it's Steppenwolf. Okay. I'm barely keeping it together.
Sorry.
Trying to keep this all straight. Don't throw names at me that aren't in the movie that I noticed. Steppenwolf is the back, not a strength, okay? It's a CGI creation, tall, fiery horns, wants to destroy Earth or something like that.
Sounds terrifying.
Yeah, that's not good. It's a step forward from Batman v Superman, so I don't want to entirely trash it. They've made some improvements. There's a little more personality here. The main issue I have it still is, you know, I jokingly use the word soggy, but this movie does look like it's been left out in the rain. There's way too much of it that I've complained before. It has this dreary CGI darkness where battles are taking place clearly nowhere in any sort of real space. And there's a blurriness to a lot of the images. It doesn't help here that the Flash, whenever he is shown in super speed, which is slow motion, which makes things blurry, that's just not very exciting visually. And there's a whole sequence set underwater because Aquaman is here as well. So obviously things get a little wet there. It's just not visually crisp in many areas. And we've seen how, I don't want to make this a Marvel versus DC thing, we've seen how crisp action can be done really well because it was in Wonder Woman this summer. Though that beach action scene was fantastic. And part of that was because there was a clarity there. There's very little of it here in Justice League. So that's just something, you know, that's always going to bother me. I even complained about it in the recent Thor movie, which I otherwise liked. So what else can I say about this? Wonder Woman, I think, has done a little bit of a disservice after such a great showing in this summer's film. She's clearly powerful here and actually comes across as the most powerful of the bunch and should really be in charge. But you also notice, and maybe this comes from having seen a superhero movie directed by a woman, you notice some shots which are, you know, oh, why are we seeing her from that angle? Or jokes that are made about her which have innuendo tied to them. These are just things that weren't in Wonder Woman, and they don't need to be here because at this point, not only do we not need them at all, but they're not true to how this character has been set up or is used to being treated. As far as that personality, okay, the Flash is played by Ezra Miller. You know, he's funny, but this is a case of them trying to play catch up with Marvel still. He's pretty much doing the eager to be there, little bit scared, jokey Spider-Man that Tom Holland is giving us. So Aquaman is played by
Jason Momoa.
Thank you. Who is amusing, I guess. He kind of seems like he walked in from a Fast and Furious film and doesn't quite fit with the tone going here. I don't know that he's bad. It's just kind of odd the way he brings this cocky, hard-drinking, tattooed, I think Aquaman might fly at one point. He's just kind of confusing. Here's the strength of it, though, is the other new member of the team is Cyborg, who, well, he's a cyborg. I'm still trying to understand how and what he can actually do, but he can do a lot. What's interesting about him is the performance given by Ray Fisher. He's somewhat of a Frankenstein's monster in that he was created by his father, and there's a real sadness to him that you wish could be explored a little bit further. He gets a few moments, and Fisher is excellent in them, which points to really the larger problem, and I'll wrap up here, is that you understand how smart it was for Marvel to introduce all of these characters a film at a time for a few years leading up to the Avengers, because Justice League is really working hard to give us the backstory for these three new characters, make us care for them deeply in a way that we came to care for a number of the Marvel figures, and you just can't do it in a movie that blessedly runs only 2 hours. You know, I'm not asking for them to do a 3-hour version, so we get all this. It's just, you know, they're still playing catch up, and I wonder if they would be better off to just change the game entirely and go for a different approach. So Wonder Woman was a few steps forward. This one, you know, a little bit of a step back.
Justice League, it's currently playing in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with Josh's take on the movie, feedback@filmspotting.net is the email.
There are stories about what happened.
It's true.
No, we didn't play the wrong Star Wars trailer. That was 2015's The Force Awakens. The sequel, the Rian Johnson directed The Last Jedi, arrives on the 15th of December. Next week, it's Thanksgiving here, so there won't be a new full show, but we will have some new content for you. We thought, why not rewatch The Force Awakens as a little bit of prep for The Last Jedi, and then we'll see if we actually were right about the movie. Next week, our plan is to replay our original 2015 review, which we had just walked out of the theater, so it was a still processing review, and it was spoiler-free for the most part. We did actually do a little break and spent another 8 to 10 minutes or so getting into some spoiler talk, but after we replay that, we're going to share some thoughts on our revisit, and we're going to share our reactions to some of your feedback to The Force Awakens, things you agreed with, things you mostly disagreed with, and many of you disliked about that movie. We're going to see if any of you guys had some validity to those points or not.
Did you rewatch it yet?
No, not yet.
Okay, we did.
Tomorrow night I have to do it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It is kind of fun to watch it outside of all of that intense craziness. You know, I've seen it twice because I went back with the whole family when it came out in theaters after we had gone to that press screening. But it had been a while. And so, yeah, it was fun to take another look at it.
Yeah, I'm going to watch it with my kids. I think a few of them have not seen it. Maybe only the oldest has. So I am excited about that. And we will also, as part of that show, replay our interview with Rian Johnson, the writer-director of The Last Jedi. He was featured on our 500th episode live. And of course, Rian is all in the news these days, Josh, because they're apparently banking on big things from The Last Jedi as he's going to direct an entire trilogy of Star Wars films after this one. Can't say I'm surprised. I have high hopes and big expectations for him because of my appreciation for his prior work. And obviously, as someone who we can actually call a friend of the show, I'm excited for him. This is kind of unbelievable to think back to 2005 and Brick, the movie that inspired our golden bricks because we talked about it so much. And here he is now, one of the biggest directors going.
I wonder if this was his long game. You know, he had this other trilogy in his mind, so I'm just going to really nail Last Jedi, so they give me a chance.
Maybe that's it.
Whatever the case, it speaks to their confidence in The Last Jedi, which is encouraging. And yeah, of course I'm up for more Rian Johnson Star Wars films. I do hope he'll be able to do other things as well. It's kind of like the situation with Taika Waititi doing Thor, right? Glad he did Thor. He brought a lot to Thor that another director might not have, but someone that unique and talented like Johnson and Waititi, you want them to be able to do some unique stuff as well.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the long game, and I have been thinking about the fact here recently that we had a film spotting t-shirt, an early version of a film spotting t-shirt going back to 2005, 2006, where we had a quote on the back from Rian Johnson, a quote taken from our show where at the end of the interview, we thanked him for his time, wished him all the best of luck. And he concluded by saying something along the lines of, "You guys are great. Thank you. You're a force for good in the universe."
See?
So what did he know even back then in 2005?
He already had it in his mind.
When we get back after that semi-week off, we plan currently to reflect on one of the great movie years of all time, 2007. It's going to be one of our last chances to have kind of a 10th anniversary look back at that year when it was There Will Be Blood versus No Country for Old Men battling for Best Picture. We're not sure yet whether we're going to do A Sacred Cow. Probably that over a blind spotting, though there are some movies from that year, notable ones that I would like to see for the first time, some others that I'd like to revisit. Maybe we'll do a top five list that revolves around that year. If you've got any great ideas, we would love to hear them. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
How great of a year was 2007, Adam? You want to hear?
I do.
How great a year? There Will Be Blood. Not good enough to make my top 10 list.
You're insane.
I'm not kidding you.
Well, I can only make fun of you to a point. I think I had it at number 6.
Ooh.
So, yeah.
That probably hurts you more than me not having it on my top 10 hurts.
It might, though. I mean, you should just be disqualified from talking about 07 after confessing to that, Josh. Our website, filmspotting.net, is also where you can participate in our biweekly poll questions. And last week on the show, we asked you, have you seen Tommy Wiseau's The Room or some variation on that as we look ahead to The Disaster Artist coming out? So far anyway, maybe it's because we beat ourselves up so much during the asking of the question. We haven't really had any complaints so far about the wording of this poll question, despite the fact that it was worded as if Tommy Wiseau maybe himself had written it for us. So we appreciate everyone who has voted, everyone who has left a comment. We will get to those results next week on the show. You still have time to vote. We're just really gauging interest sort of in The Disaster Artist, but we can also say that our producer in particular, and I'm with him to an extent, Sam is really curious just how many people have even bothered to see the film. Yes, it's this cult classic. Yes, it's an infamous movie, as the trailer for The Disaster Artist suggests. But how many people have actually taken the time to see it? We want to know. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. That is also where you can find our merch store. There is a Black Friday sale coming up Wednesday, November 22nd through Saturday the 25th. T-shirts for $14 or a coffee mug or a notebook or something else. Josh, is there going to be a Black Friday sale on your book, Movies Are Prayers?
You know, I'm looking at this. What does this say that even for the Black Friday sale at $14, the t-shirts are more than it costs to buy my book?
You're right.
Months of hard work.
Months. Way more work went into that book than we put into those t-shirts.
And yet they cost more. I'm just depressed now.
I bet. Filmspotting.net/shop is where you will find Josh's book. Josh's book that he worked very hard on, and the t-shirts that we didn't work hard on at all, but the people who made them did, and we're proud of those shirts. Our website is also where you can check in to see if you live in the Chicago area, if there are movie passes available, often for advanced screening, sometimes during a movie's run of engagement. And as of this taping, there's nothing currently up, Josh, but we did recently have passes up for Three Billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri, the Martin McDonough film that we both are excited to see finally here at some point, and Roman J. Israel, the new one starring Denzel Washington. So we just like to throw it out there. Just a little reminder, events at the top of the page of filmspotting.net is where you can find those passes. We got a little bit of feedback just today, actually, Josh, and I was all set to answer this query from Ross Woolman, longtime listener of the show. And then I thought, well, I could actually just answer it on the air and give a little bit of assistance maybe to people like Ross who have similar questions they're looking to be answered. And this one came in with the subject line, top five Stephen King scares, a recent list we did here on the show tying in with our review of It.
I love to be scared, but I'm a real coward when it comes to committing to these films. I usually take a moment late at night and look up the movie on themoviespoiler.com, reading the film synopsis with sweaty palms and shortness of breath. I'm a bit younger than you, and I'd love to see the clips you described in the top five. Is there a YouTube playlist or shortcut for this yellow film fan? Thanks again for the great shows. Ross, the rabid reactionary woman.
Yeah, Ross used to be in Chicago, now in Scottsdale, Arizona, and you can tell just how far back he goes with the show. He has his very own Sam Van Halgren nickname. The answer to your question, Ross, is yeah, you can actually watch all of those scenes except for one just by going to filmspotting.net and click on lists and click on top five lists, and we post the top five lists for every show. And I definitely, Josh, and you to an extent, I've gone out of my way to try to link every one of our choices to a scene from the film. If it applies, it's the scene from the film that you actually hear during the top five. Sometimes, though, I just include a scene that I think is a good scene from the movie or one that seems the most appropriate for the film, because maybe you're listening and you aren't familiar with that film and you want a one-stop shop to see the movie that we are discussing or see that specific scene we are discussing on the show. And if you do go to that Stephen King list, you can see all five of my scenes and four of Josh's. The only one we couldn't find actually was your number one, the room 237 sequence from The Shining. Curiously, I could not find a good version of that on YouTube. There were some different scenes that maybe they added their own music or did different things to manipulate it, but just that scene itself, I couldn't find it. But otherwise, they're all there. Just go to filmspotting.net and click on lists. With that, we'll get to Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a prize. A couple weeks back, we massacred this.
You owe me money. You give me $5. Well, you get out.
I thought you always helped people in trouble.
Hey, kid. This is the city. I don't help anybody but myself.
But I will...
Get lost!
Wait! I know why you're not acting like yourself. You don't have your special helmet. See, you're wearing the baseball hat. You're supposed to be wearing this. Take mine. Go on, take it.
You giving this to me?
Oh, yeah. You're my hero.
Here. Here, take the car.
Thanks, Thor.
That was Vincent D'Onofrio. Yes, the mystery man himself playing Dawson, also known as Thor, with Maya Bruton playing Sarah in 1987's Adventures in Babysitting. It was written by David Simkins and directed by Chris Columbus.
That massacre part of a show that also included our review of Thor Ragnarok and our top five superhero costumes. And yes, as acknowledged during the top five, we probably should have called them suits or uniforms. But we didn't get much grief for that, Josh, I'm happy to report. We did hear from Angel, or Angel, from Alameda, California, who said, I immediately knew the answer to this massacre theater for once. The film is Adventures in Babysitting, and starring in this role, the prominent actor, Vincent D'Onofrio. The tie-in is the fact that the little girl in the movie is obsessed with Thor. She wears a Thor costume during most of the movie and offers D'Onofrio's surly mechanic character her helmet to make him act like himself. Apparently, both of you had a crush on Elizabeth Shue, who plays the babysitter. Well, actually, that was Josh and Sam who had that crush on Elizabeth Shue.
Yeah, who was your crush? Someone else in the movie?
I think I said I was a little bit more, no, a Mia Sara guy, a Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, okay.
Ferris's girlfriend.
Fair enough.
Maybe okay. Over Elizabeth Shue at the time.
Okay, that's fine. Rod Lott wrote in from flickattack.com and Oklahoma City. Sadly, I didn't need your extra hints that the answer is Adventures in Babysitting. When that came out in the summer of 1987, I was 16 and instantly smitten with Elizabeth Shue, so much so that I caught it in the theater six times. Six. I have seen The Godfather only once, but I have seen Shue dance in her t-shirt to Then He Kissed Me half a dozen times. And that doesn't even account for subsequent viewings on VHS. Forgive me. Fast forward to 2000, when my daughter was born and I suggested naming her after Elizabeth Shue. Turns out my wife was not as keen to allow our child to be christened with the moniker of my relentless teenage crush. But she did allow it for our daughter's middle name, Elizabeth with an S, not a Z, just like Ms. Shue herself.
Wow.
Perhaps I should note that we are no longer married. I may no longer love the mother of my children, but I still love the fantasy girl next door babysitter that was Elizabeth Shue. The movie, not so much. What was I thinking? Man, Rod, that took a dark turn.
It did, but I think the lesson there is don't name your children after movie characters. I remember seeing Adventures in Babysitting in the theater in my small little town in Iowa in 1987, but I only watched it once and was not as smitten with her or the movie. I did go to YouTube right after reading this email and typed in Elizabeth Shue, Then She Kissed Me, so I could watch that opening scene. And let's just say it's not the most sensual, seductive performance ever. She's doing a lot of dancing. Elizabeth Shue is working very hard in that scene.
Well, judging by the staging and pacing of the scene we massacred,
right.
I can assume it's not the greatest.
Steve O'Dell in Grand Rapids, Michigan said Chris Columbus went on to direct Kenneth Branagh in Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, another tie-in. Branagh went on to direct the first Thor movie.
There you go. Scott from Gainesville, Georgia said D'Onofrio is now an official member of the MCU while also making D'Onofrio-ish choices as Kingpin in Netflix's Daredevil. And like Film Spotting, Daredevil is also set in Chicago. Was it W.C. Fields who said don't work with children? Well, maybe adults doing child voices is a bad idea too.
I don't know what you mean, Scott.
I know why you're not acting like yourself. You don't have your special helmet.
Yikes.
Yeah, I mean, Trevor Brown really nailed it. Josh, I know that you said you had never acted as a kid before. Well, I recommend that you never do it again. One word, creepy.
See, I told you. It's not just me. When anyone does it, it's creepy.
Any
adult playing a child.
Creepier?
Creepy. Kevin Bester from Oak Park, Illinois. Shout out to Fitzgerald's in Berwyn, which is currently for sale. The blues bar scene from the movie was filmed at Fitzgerald, as well as the scene in A League of Their Own, when the girls escape finishing school and go out dancing.
Maybe like Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal in Running Scared, we should retire, though not as cops. We should retire as hosts of Film Spotting and buy a bar. What do you say, Josh?
No, I think we should stick with this.
Okay, fair enough. I did want to make mention of the fact that multiple people in answering Massacre Theater did lump me in with you.
Oh.
In being very mad about the fact.
Poor guy.
Yeah. That we seemed to trash The Rocketeer, even as you had that costume, your number five. And I just want to say that, well, you might be right. Josh did kind of pay some backhanded compliments to that film.
Yes.
But I haven't seen The Rocketeer, so you can't lump me in with him.
Yeah, no, leave Adam out of it. I'm quite certain that the best thing about The Rocketeer is its costume design.
Okay, so you're doubling down.
And production design.
You're doubling down.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty confident.
I'm really glad we brought that up. Let's reach into the film spotting hat, which is brimming. Apparently, a lot of Elizabeth Shue aficionados out there. Josh, reach in and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Andrea Cooper from Houston.
Congratulations, Andrea. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with your very own film spotting t-shirt, or you could go with a mug or a notebook. Not Josh's book, though.
Too cheap.
Why don't we try reading the scene?
Yeah, let's just do this. Okay? Now, what we need here is hot. You two are about to rip each other's clothes off. Okay?
Gotcha. Yeah.
We move on to this very tasty edition of Massacre Theater. One I think that is going to put Josh's funny voice acting chops to their ultimate test.
Yeah, this is an iconic part. So I did a practice run earlier today. And
had
all I
rehearse.
Can say is I scared the dog.
Well,
it was just me and the dog. She looked at me like she'd never looked at me before, concerned, terrified.
Well, let's
not
delay.
So we'll see how that goes.
Let's get right to it then. We will point out that the main character's name is mentioned at least once. We have changed that name to try to make it a little less obvious. This should be incredibly obvious, and the only way it won't be is if Josh screws it up.
Thanks for the pressure.
Okay. I started off. You're going to give me the action.
And action.
The world's finest surfers showed up today to do battle with what's turned out to be the biggest waves to hit this coast since 1946. Hello, everybody. I'm Stu Nahan, and I'd like you to meet this young man. His name, Alex Dwyer. And Alex, congratulations to you. Things look rough out there today.
Oh, I'll tell you, Stu. I did battle with some humongous waves. But you know, just like I told the guy on ABC, danger is my business.
Let me ask you a question. When you get out there, do you ever fear for your life?
Well, Stu, I'll tell you, surfing's not a sport. It's a way of life, no hobby. It's a way of looking at that wave and saying, hey, bud, let's party. Where'd you get this jacket?
I got this from the network. Let me ask you a question. What's next for Alex Dwyer?
Heading over to the Australian and then the Hawaiian Internationals. Then me and Mick are going to wing on over to London and jam with the Stones.
and
scene.
You nailed it.
Not bad.
No, you nailed it.
All right.
No, that's not how you say all right. You got to say it like this character might.
All right.
That's much better. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, November 27th. And no, it's not Finding Nemo.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
You know, there is something about a tangle of strangers pressed together for days with nothing in common but the need to go from one place to another and never see each other again.
A clip there from Murder on the Orient Express, starring and directed by Kenneth Branagh, came out last week in wide release, and somehow I managed to find the time to see this movie. I won't get into the details of it, but I actually had 2 hours to kill in a movie theater really close nearby. And I thought, okay, I've already done my homework. I saw Wonderstruck earlier that day. We'll get to that in a moment. Now I'm just going to go for some mindless fun, hopefully, and watch Murder on the Orient Express. And I have to say, it's exactly what I think we all probably expected it was. A mildly entertaining diversion, though not one I can recommend to anyone. Everyone in the ensemble, as you might imagine, acquits themselves pretty well. I think Daisy Ridley, Willem Dafoe, and Michelle Pfeiffer are probably the standouts for me, and I'm a much bigger fan of Branagh's performance as an actor here versus a director. His Hercule Poirot is really fun, actually, and he's clearly savoring biting into a character with Poirot's quirks and presence and talents and lines of dialogue, just the words he gets to say, without full-blown scenery chewing. He does a really nice job. But from a direction standpoint, Josh, there are some really odd structural choices with the movie and really a lot of distracting camera choices, whether they're long moving takes up the train or one scene that plays out with the camera completely overhead in one of the train's cabins. They succeed in drawing way more attention to themselves as kind of nifty camera shots rather than actually offering us a compelling perspective. They had nothing new to the scene at all. They're flashy and stylish it seemed to me, for the sake of flash and style. And overall, it's just not light enough or swift enough to be the cheeky romp that it probably could have been, nor is it weighty enough, even with the time Branagh does give to all the talk and depictions of heinous crimes and revenge and moral quandaries, to provoke any real emotional response or intellectual response. Actually, with his character, he really seems to want to make Poirot more of a tortured soul. And every time he does it, it feels completely thrown in and disconnected from the rest of the story. So it's certainly not a bad film, but it's not one that I can encourage you to spend your time on.
Do you feel worse about voting against the ensemble in our poll question, or do you feel better?
No, I feel better about it. Okay. I definitely feel better.
There you go.
So saw that, and also did see Wonderstruck, which you talked about and recommended on last week's show, the latest film from Todd Haynes. As I said on Twitter, I think you undersold this movie. I think I liked it more than you. It definitely is a movie that's contending for my top 10 at this point in the year. And I re-listened to your thoughts. You didn't go off course in any way. You were absolutely correct in urging families to take their kids to see it, though I don't think either of us are going to promise that your 12-year-old is necessarily going to be enraptured by it. You were also correct in praising Haynes' visual craftsmanship and the way large portions of the movie play out like a silent film. Appropriate, as you noted, for storylines involving not only a young deaf girl, but a young deaf girl fascinated by silent films and one silent film star in particular. I really loved all of those sequences as well. Now, two names somehow in your 5 to 7 minutes of talking that you didn't mention at all, unless I missed them, Carter Burwell and his score.
Yeah.
Is magnificent.
It really is amazing.
Admittedly, it might be because when you're watching a movie that is filled with largely silent sequences, you're more aware of the music, but it's without a doubt my favorite score so far this year.
The hints in it I loved from the Miller's Crossing theme that he did. That's actually the first time I noticed. I appreciated the score, and then I was like, oh, I know who this is.
Yeah.
But it was just enough of a touch. Yeah, it was wonderful.
The other name, Millicent Simmons, who perhaps because she is actually deaf, is authentic and perfectly expressive as that young girl without ever crossing into melodrama the way some of the authority figures do with their broader strokes in their performance. But that's appropriate too, because they are, to her, almost these villains out of these types of films. Her smile, which you don't see that often in the movie, melted me every time she employed it. And there is a moment in the movie where the two storylines, one revolving around her character in the 1920s and one revolving around another 12-year-old in New York in the 1970s, at the point where those do converge, I was doing everything I could, frankly, in the theater to keep it together. It really hit me hard, and I think it is the combination of the emotional elements of the story and the magic of the convergence itself, where you see it coming to an extent. There are lots of hints and breadcrumbs along the way, so you are expecting certain things, and it delivers. And then at the same time, there are other little moments of discovery that are threaded throughout that. So I loved everything about the last 15 to 20 minutes of this film. And I saw one listener on Twitter, Greg F., who felt otherwise and just said he wanted to be but wasn't moved by the film at all, and talked about the info dump that happens at the end of the movie. I get it, in the sense that there's a very good actress who has about 10 minutes of talking, of telling a story and relating information, but the way not only she renders those lines and the way Todd Haynes then as a director brings to life and portrays
the
story
sequence, right?
The story that she's telling
about.
Exactly. It's really wonderful. And I can't imagine being bored at all by that information being shared again, too, because I was so invested in those storylines. When you finally do see it and feel it converge, it's great.
Yeah, it was really encouraging. I did hear from a couple of people on Twitter who said they went and checked it out because we brought it up on last week's show. But I also heard from some other people who said, well, yeah, I'd like to see it, but it's nowhere near me. So even though this expanded last week, and I think to 260 theaters, it's still somewhat of a limited release.
It's still not really wide.
And, you know, there's no reason that this shouldn't play as wide as something like Hugo, the other Selznick adaptation from Martin Scorsese. So maybe it's building up to that. I don't know. But I certainly, again, would encourage you, if it's near you, go check it out. I think people will be surprised by it.
Yeah, definitely do recommend that. And one final note, I should go back and mention this with respect to Murder on the Orient Express, and with respect in particular to its lead star and director, Kenneth Branagh. It turns out, Josh, that he has been Sir Kenneth Branagh for 5 years.
What?
Yeah. Kim Very Racy Zuckert in Hollywood was not the only listener that wanted us to know that he's been Sir Kenneth Branagh along with Dame Judi Dench for some time.
And we didn't properly recognize.
We did not.
I feel so terrible about not being on top of my British pseudo royalty. I think from now, from now on, I think I have to refer to him always as Sir Kenneth Branagh. It's the best I can do.
Okay.
Sir Kenneth Branagh's first outing as a director, Henry V. Not too shabby.
Really good.
We'll look at some other impressive first-time efforts next with our top five female-directed debuts. Stay with us.
A few thank yous to get to here, Josh, as we thank everyone who threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. We start with Jessica, who wants to wish her father, Peter James, in Wales, UK, a happy 60th birthday.
Happy birthday, Peter.
Indeed. Thank you, Jessica. Thank you, Peter. David E., who says, a year ago, I was a working journalist. Now I am an involuntarily retired journalist enjoying life and long walks with my favorite podcasters. You guys mean a lot to me, so thanks. Thank you.
Sorry, Dave. Too many involuntarily retired journalists lately.
A new Silver Club donor, Stephen B., and a new $10 a month donor, Kent N. That's all I've got to go on. First names, last initials, no locations. PayPal's changed its format. We'd love to know where you guys are from. We like to mispronounce the names of where you are from. Feel free to throw those in if you get a chance.
We were all just in the locker room, and Madison went crazy.
What do you mean, crazy?
She started shaking all over the place.
Was the whole team there?
Pretty much.
You guys talking about Madison? It was crazy. She was like, and her eyes was like, and then her tongue.
This is Film Spotting. That was from The Fitz, director Anna Rose Holmer's debut movie that was last year's winner of the Film Spotting Golden Brick Award. And maybe the Golden Brick is a good place to start our conversation about our favorite directing debuts by female directors. You think about our criteria. We're looking at new filmmakers, newly established filmmakers, and films that show a clear directorial vision and artistic ambition, certainly things we're keeping in mind as we're considering which debuts will make this top five. And Holmer is actually the third woman to win the Golden Brick since we started giving out the award in 2010. The second went to Andrea Arnold for Wuthering Heights, though that wasn't her debut. We may get to a little bit on that debut film in a little bit. The first one, I'm not going to say anything about that just now. Some of the other Golden Brick nominees that were directing debuts, Lena Dunham's Tiny Furniture, Mariel Heller's Diary of a Teenage Girl in 2015, Kirsten Johnson's Camera Person in 2016, and Kelly Freeman Craig's The Edge of 17, also from 2016. So a lot of good candidates recently, and I had fully intended to leave off all these films, just make them exempt from this top five, and there was one that I love so much, I couldn't do it.
All right, well, I did set them aside. To be honest, we were looking for ways to narrow down
exactly
the field.
I couldn't believe,
because,
honestly, how big and fruitful the list was.
Once we started laying out the number of titles, so all of those very deserving to be on our list, but most of them, it sounds like, have been set aside. So what was I left with then? Well, at number five, I'm going back a little bit to Sweetie. I had this and Holy Smoke as a Jane Campion double feature pick when we did our top five teen girl movies directed by women. That was episode 613 and actually is a nice companion list to this Lady Bird show, as a matter of fact. So I'm on record as being a fan of Campion's debut. It is from 1989 and it stars Genevieve Lemon as the title character, a psychologically troubled young woman whose whimsical outbursts cause havoc for her family to a greater degree than we see in Lady Bird even. Now, much of this is seen from the perspective of Sweetie's sister, Kay, who's played by Karen Colston. And this sister relationship is, it's really as complicated as the mother and daughter one we see in Lady Bird. Campion puts the emotional volatility of this relationship right there on the movie's surface. You can see from Sweetie that Campion was provocative right from the start, certainly unapologetic about her choice of subject matter and the style with which she was going to present it. So you get a lot of potent imagery here. I especially think of this childhood tree fort that Sweetie still climbs in as a young adult, and it very much comes into play in the movie's climax. So certainly a strong directorial voice throughout this film. And really, after a long and rich career, I still include The Piano as a masterpiece. You can look at Sweetie as one of Campion's first women on the edge. So many of her pictures focus on someone like that. So Sweetie really sets in motion all the things that you'd see in this unique career that was to come.
Yeah, Sweetie remains a blind spot for me. And there were so many good options to choose from for this top five. Obviously, I'm excluding all the ones that I really want to see. And I do have a full list of these titles. Well, what I think is a full list, Josh, and I will link to that in our show notes at filmspotting.net. I'm going to post it at Letterboxd. So if you have something to add to it, if I left off a female directed debut, please do email the show or comment on Letterboxd, and I'll try to keep a master list so that everyone can reference it and seek out some of these titles. My number five is one I know we've both seen because it was part of our recent Agnes Varda marathon. It is La Pointe Court, Varda's debut movie, a film that takes place in a fisherman's village in the south of France, and you basically get a couple that is married and they're struggling with their marriage at this point, and that dialogue, really, that psychological dialogue that's going on between this couple is played out against this conflict between the authorities in this fishing village and the fishermen and their families. And I do really appreciate this movie, but I also thought about it, Josh, just in terms of the context of Agnes Varda and feeling like she had to be represented on this top five. This is a crucial French New Wave movie. You look back at titles like The 400 Blows was 59, Breathless was 60. Most of the big French New Wave titles we think of are movies that came out in the 1960s. La Pointe Court came out in 1955. Varda's shooting on location. She's using non-professional actors mixed with some professionals. This is pretty common at this point in Italian cinema, if you think about neorealism in the 40s and 50s, but not at all in French cinema at the time. So she's taking these elements of nonfiction, this relationship story, and merging it with fiction, these actual fishermen and their struggle. And there are these pioneering French New Wave elements we see, but we're also seeing things we're going to come to see from Ingmar Bergman and Antonioni, certain shots, the disconnect between the two people, the sense of alienation before either of them had really burst onto the scene. And more than anything, what you see in Varda, we talked about her last week with her great new movie, Faces Places, her empathy, her curiosity, the way her camera showcases and finds details in frames as if they're being discovered in front of our eyes. She trains her eye in such a way that she's already capturing some great shot, some lovely detail, and then something new emerges as if she didn't fully anticipate it, but she was in the right place at the right time to share it with us.
Yeah, that docudrama element, I guess you could call it, is what makes La Pointe Court such a nice bookend with Faces, Places. Though, of course, you could say the same of The Beaches of Agnes.
Right.
She's such a strong presence in these pictures. So definitely consider La Pointe Court for my list. At number four, I went with Eve's Bayou, Cassie Lemon's 1997 period drama set in an affluent African-American community in 1960s. Louisiana. This is mostly told through the eyes of 10-year-old Eve, played by Journey Smollett, who gets thrown headfirst into the reality of adult sins, adult passions, when she discovers her doctor father, who's played by Samuel L. Jackson, is having an affair. Lemons really makes the most of this Southern Gothic setting. The movie, it registers as a film about hauntings in a lot of ways. In some instances, this is literal. People are haunted by those who have died, but also characters are haunted by their past actions, and it kind of – that seeps through this entire film. I especially like this visual touch she brings to a scene when Eve's aunt, who's played by Debbie Morgan, tells stories from earlier in her life, mm-hmm. and her mirror becomes this window to the flashbacks. So instead of cutting to flashbacks, we see them right there in the scene, past and present take place within the same frame. Eve's Bayou was a really unique vision. It was written by Lemons. And again, she has that Southern Gothic style that I mentioned, but there are also hints of Tennessee Williams here. There are visual touches of magical realism thrown into the mix too. So it really is something. She went on to make three other features. I also like 2007's Talk to Me quite a bit. But Don Cheadle, really good in that film. But I think Eve's Bayou, her first film, still remains her strongest for me.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Eve's Bayou as well. In fact, I too have it at number four. It's a movie that I rewatched back in the summer of 2014 for my tribute to Roger Ebert class because he had just passed away around that time. And thinking back to the movies that I sought out specifically because he championed them, Eve's Bayou was a no-brainer for that syllabus. I watched that movie on DVD in 1997 only because of Ebert's praise. 17 years later, watching it again, I discovered that as much as I did appreciate, just like you, some of those visual touches, it's a little more overwrought maybe and melodramatic than I remembered, but it was also more tightly constructed and well-crafted than I remembered, and I really liked it a lot originally. I wrote on Letterboxd at the time that it's Exhibit 517 in proving the limitations of the Bechdel test because there are lots of women in this movie who are named, who talk to each other in this movie, and it's almost always about a man. In this case, it's usually Samuel L. Jackson's philandering husband. And yet, after class, when we were having our discussion, one of the female students right away said, that was some strong feminist shit. And it is. And I think that's because of how complexly and how carefully drawn the female characters are, and specifically their relationships to each other. I think that the performance by Journey Smollett is really good. It's much more than just a precocious young kid. She's really funny and hits the necessary emotional notes.
What did you do to your brother?
I'm going to push him out of a window if I don't get out of this house.
Eve!
Cicely's been in the goddamn bathtub for an hour. You know that? She stayed in there 3 hours yesterday.
Fortunately, there's more than one bathroom in this house.
Ain't that much dirt in all Louisiana. Get out of the damn tub!
You watch your language, young lady.
Mommy keeps stabbing herself in the kitchen. Show her your hands, Mama.
I think you better hush.
And where's Daddy? He's never home. He's supposed to be home sometimes.
Listen, you little ingrate. Your father works hard so we can have a house with four bathrooms.
Not every night he's not working. I know he's not.
I think, too, like Lady Bird, the movie that inspired this top five, it's a coming-of-age film where we see someone at a much earlier stage. This is a coming-of-age tale about a character who comes of age too soon. Mm-hmm. It's about that moment, right, where you kind of bite the apple, whether you wanted to actually bite it or not. You realize that your family life is a fantasy or has been up to this point. You have to reconcile your perception of it with reality. And she is the only character, Eve, who's really dogged in her pursuit of the truth, more so than the adults who have maybe resigned themselves to just denying that reality for whatever reason, because it helps them sleep at night, because they get to live in a comfortable home, whatever the case may be. Now, I will point out that another student in that class, a very fine Chicago critic named Daniel Nava, wrote on Letterboxd that he didn't like the movie at all, and he acknowledged that it has its virtues, including the way it showcases minority women, but he really questioned the portrayal of black men in the film. He said that basically every black man in the movie falls into the type of philanderer slash potential pedophile, drug addict, drunk, or a gun-toting maniac, and the others are all periphery characters who are either handicapped mutes or stoic silent figures. That may perhaps fit in some way to what you're saying in terms of the Southern Gothic element of this film, or the way some of these men that are being portrayed truly were, and the way they treated women. He might be onto something. that's something for another revisit of Eve's Bayou.
Yeah, because for me, I don't think I've actually revisited it in full since 97 or right around 97. So certainly would like to do that. But I'm glad it made both of our lists. At number three, I have A New Leaf, which was my pick for Best Picture in our Elaine May marathon. I think might have been your pick for Best Picture in that marathon as well. This has Walter Matthau as Henry Graham, a once rich bachelor who has blithely spent all of his inheritance yet continues to live as if that wasn't the case. May herself shows up as Henrietta Lowell, this klutzy heiress who Henry targets for this dark scheme he has. He's going to marry her, then he's going to kill her, and he'll get all of her money and can continue to live as he wishes. I really love their meet cute in this movie. This is at a high society tea party, and at the very least, they both prove that they're kindred spirits in that they both stick out like sore thumbs in this posh crowd.
She's not engaged?
No. She's a botanist. Teaches it somewhere. Writes a lot of papers on fronds for periodicals. Doesn't write either. Doesn't entertain. Doesn't even talk, as far as I can tell. I think she's about the most isolated woman I've ever met.
Rich, single, isolated. She's about to drop that teacup.
Now, despite the movie's morbid setup, May manages a really unique combination of slapstick and sincere sentimentality throughout this film. She almost pulls out a romantic comedy from this material. I think it's especially silly and sweet during their honeymoon scene. I talked about how Henrietta gets caught in her nightgown and they kind of fumble through it. And there's just a couple of different emotional tones at play there, along with it being quite funny. I think there are some hints in that moment, as we talked about, of the improvised sketches that May had done with Mike Nichols. So I really enjoyed that Elaine May marathon. Didn't know what I was going to get into. Certainly knew Ishtar's reputation, ended up liking Ishtar quite a bit, and just about all the films we watched. So A New Leaf, though, for me, best of the bunch.
Yeah, definitely an honorable mention for me. It was my best picture in the marathon, as it was yours, and we both picked our favorite scenes from the marathon from A New Leaf. Yours was Henrietta being trapped in the nightgown, and mine was Henry, Walter Matthau, going to visit his banker, which I'm laughing just thinking about the dialogue of that scene. My number three is a movie I watched as homework for this top five, and I'm really glad I did. It's Ratcatcher from Lynn Ramsey, a director whose last film, We Need to Talk About Kevin, we were not fans of. And after seeing Ratcatcher, a similarly disturbing sit in many ways, I do want to revisit Kevin and see if there was something I missed there. This is a movie that's set in the mid-70s in Glasgow, Scotland. It's another coming-of-age tale. It's about a 12-year-old boy named James who is burdened with, among other things, his involvement, the memory and the knowledge of his involvement in a tragic incident that happens at the beginning of the movie. I said this was a disturbing watch. It is, in many ways, a very tough sit. You have characters, Josh, literally living in filth. Their flats are surrounded by garbage. I'm not sure what the exact scenario is. I haven't looked it up, whether it's a strike of some kind or the services to these neighborhoods just aren't what they should be. But people are literally just throwing their trash out their windows or putting it out on the street. And there's a canal behind these flats that's so dirty and scary that it made me think of the gross pool in La Cienega, Lucretia Martel's film that we talked about as part of our new Argentine cinema marathon, and another movie I thought of for this list. Everyone is struggling. Everyone wants out of this neighborhood, and they really have no hope. But Ramsey's eye is not only amazing, it's her ability to infuse the seemingly most dreadful moments with some tenderness and the most tender moments with dread. There's one, and there's many throughout the film, but there's one I think of right away where James is sitting with an older girl, and she's wearing a skirt, and her legs are showing, and she lets him put his hand on her knee, which has this bright red scrape on it. They're sharing something really intimate in this moment, but Ramsey's also not letting you forget that she just got that really painful-looking scrape because she was being picked on and abused physically by another group of boys in the neighborhood, and the red stands out so much against the gray and the black of these streets in a way that makes it oddly beautiful and disturbing at the exact same time. You understand the way James and these other characters feel so trapped in this world that it's as if the world doesn't exist beyond what you see on the television. There's really no sense that they could ever experience anything outside of these streets. And yet it does happen at one point, fairly early into the film, a remarkable sequence where James gets on a bus, has no idea where it's going, steals some money from his father, gets on a bus just to see where it will take him. And he ends up out in the countryside. And he goes through a house, a new housing development, and just kind of messes around. And at one point, he comes to a window or where a window is going to be. And the framing of it, Josh, makes it feel like a movie screen, as if he is entering a portal, not just into the outside, but into some other world, some other dimension, leaving these streets behind and ending up in this field with the green of the hills and the brown of the wheat and the blue sky. And suddenly it's breathtaking. And we've never had a moment like that in this movie up to this point to catch our breath the way James is catching his breath there.
Yeah, I've not been able to catch up with Ratcatcher, though I think I'll have an excuse to do that. And Ramsey's other film, she's got a new one coming out. It's in the UK this fall and winter, mm-hmm. but I think February 2018 with Joaquin Phoenix. So
okay.
That should be interesting.
So can't wait.
I will do some homework before then. At my number two slot, I have Away From Her. Now, some of our picks, I think you can maybe see here and there where these were first-time efforts. There are little things that might be polished later on in the filmmaker's career. Maybe a new leaf, you could point to some things here and there that we talked about in our review. But Away From Her, Sarah Polley's debut, this thing seemed to emerge fully, almost perfectly formed. It's a shockingly confident work of screenwriting and of direction. And should probably note that it is an adaptation. Polley adapted an Alice Munro short story here. Aside from the movie itself, I think the subject matter is decidedly mature, focuses on an older couple who's been married for 50 years, and now they're negotiating the challenges of the wife's encroaching Alzheimer's. So you have Julie Christie and Gordon Pinsent as this couple, and I'm sure their decades of acting experience brought some stability to the production.
I'm happy to see you. You could have just driven away. Just driven away without a care in the world and forsook me. Forsooken me. Forsaken.
Not a chance.
Christie especially, she's just amazing as this woman who's descending into this foggy fear. But Polly's command of the material, it's impeccable. I mean, she really makes this a shattering romance in a lot of ways. She just manages to convey how love is so fragile and so precious in this particular scenario, for sure. So it was really hard for me not to have Away From Her at number one just because of that confidence the film has, but it's solidly sitting here in the second slot on my list.
I love that movie, and I'm glad it made your list an honorable mention for me. My number two is the movie, Josh, that I wanted to leave out. I wanted to set it aside because it is a Golden Brick winner here on the show, but I love it so much that I had to make room for it. It is The Arbor from director Cleo Barnard. This is the experimental documentary that chronicles, in a way, the life of Andrea Dunbar, who was a poet. She was hailed at one point as the genius from the slum. She grew up in the type of neighborhood we see in Ratcatcher. And as a teenager, she wrote a play called The Arbor, and it actually gained some notoriety and attention, was performed in London. She went on to write another play called Rita, Sue, and Bob 2 that was then made into the film. And by age 29, she couldn't overcome her demons and she was dead. Barnard decides to tell Dunbar's story by having actual people who knew her, including her children, tell their stories. She films those interviews and then she has actors and actresses perform those roles, lip-syncing their actual dialogue for the camera. Another movie that's difficult to watch at times because of some of the stories we hear. Neglected children, all these people struggling with substance abuse, but it is a movie that's ultimately about the power of art and the limitations of art. You have someone who has an immense amount of talent and yet can't totally overcome and escape her surroundings. And the lip-syncing technique here, I think, is so effective for a few reasons. It allows us to really confront the horror, I think, in a way, by having just enough distance because of the artifice. It also, Josh, gets at the fundamental dilemma in any kind of artistic endeavor that surrounds real people and real experiences. What's true? What's manufactured? What's been added or omitted? Whose truth? Whose perspective is being passed on? And Barnard here is determined, it seems, not to romanticize this the way a narrative version, a more traditional biopic, if you will, might. She's also not going to suggest that there's one official version of this story the way a more traditional documentary might. And then the big thing for me, Josh, is the way Barnard replicates the process that Dunbar herself was engaged in. Dunbar was taking existing material, the material of her life, the people around her and their environment, the things they said, the things they did, and she dramatized it. She brought it to life for an audience, and Barnard is here using Dunbar's art, her process, and her life to create another piece of art. She's extending the art in a way as opposed to just saying, this is going to be an investigation. It's its own wholly unique, wholly troubling, and wonderful piece of art.
Being in the house, mum out in the pub, mum comatosed in bed, and setting fire to the bedroom to keep my brother and sister warm because it was cold.
I can remember Lorraine setting the bedroom on fire. And I were only young then, I was probably only about five. But still to this day, if you talk about it to me aunties and stuff, and this, they'll say, we don't know which one of yous it was. And I'm like, it won't be, because I can actually remember it to this day. She was messing with matches and the mattress caught fire.
Yeah, you can hardly think of a golden brickier model, I'd say, right, than this film, right? With the levels of formal ingenuity going on. It's really, really creative. My number one slot, I am giving to Daughters of the Dust, Julie Dash's 1991 debut. This made the festival rounds with a restored print last year, and that was when I finally had a chance to catch up with it. I had never seen it before. It takes place in 1902 on an island off the coast of Georgia, where a community of slave descendants has existed for generations. So this isolation has allowed for a culture that's still deeply attuned to their African ancestors. And Daughters of the Dust, it immerses you in that culture with the very texture of the film. So there are multiple narrators, stories from the past mixed with visions of the future. Sometimes characters will just pause and they'll pose in front of these striking tableaus to allow you to closely observe the clothes they're wearing or the setting they're in. The whole experience feels like something that's out of place and time, even though it's very historically rooted.
Eli, Eli, there's a thought, a recollection, something somebody remembers. We carry these memories inside of we. Do you believe that those hundreds and hundreds of Africans brought here on this other side will forget everything they once knew? We don't know where the recollection comes from. Sometimes we dream them, but we carry these memories inside of we.
What are we supposed to remember, Nana? How we one time was able to protect those we love? On the Africa where we were kings and queens and built great big cities?
I'm trying to learn you how to touch your own spirit. I'm fighting for my life, and I'm fighting for yourn. Look in my face.
I think a lot of times we go to the movies and we want to see ourselves or our experiences reflected on the screen and say something like, yes, I've known that, or I've felt that way too. But I think, you know, often just as powerful of an experience can be those movies that pull back a curtain on a world that you never knew existed or a world that maybe you neglected in some way. And Daughters of the Dust was one of those latter experiences for me, just absolutely unique among the thousands of pictures that I've seen. Now, as for Julie Dash, she went on to do a number of shorts and television work since 1991. Currently, she is working on a documentary about Verdamé Grosnever, a black food activist of the civil rights era who actually had a small part in Daughters of the Dust.
Hmm. That is another one, Josh, from your list that I have been longing to see for some time. My number one is a classic documentary, and it's Barbara Kopple's Harlan County, USA. If you look at any list, and in fact, a new list just came out this week, a listener shared with us, it's not ranked, but Vogue Online did their top 61, and I'm not sure how they landed on 61 documentaries ever, Harlan County, USA on the list. It's going to be on most top 10 lists or even top 5 lists of the greatest documentaries ever, and that's for good reason. It's a magnificent expose of the coal miners' strike against the Brookside Mining Company that took place in 1973 in Harlan County, Kentucky. And as I knew this movie had to be my number one, Josh, I realized going through my picks that all of my choices, maybe one exception, involve people on the fringes of society. I think the exception would be, you could argue, Eve's Bayou. They're a pretty affluent family in that film. But otherwise, all of my choices are about people who are impoverished or largely voiceless. And I wonder if there's something to that, in that women are telling these stories, or I just didn't get creative enough with my picks. But the same way we talked about Varda recently, representing the people who get overlooked in certain environments or certain situations and giving them their due, Kopple examines every angle and perspective of this conflict. And it really has become the model for so many documentary films that have followed. Kopple was 26 years old when this movie was made. You talk about assured debuts, putting herself right in the middle of this struggle, which got increasingly more contentious.
And it's time for us to stand together and get just as violent as they are. They're violent, so by God, you fight far with far.
It seemed like they were pretty well organized to me this morning, and we're going to have to get a little tighter organized. We're going to get together, the women are going to get together and be responsible for 10 women each, or 10 people up there each at 4 o'clock.
If you women going to bring 10 each, then the men ought to be able to say, well, we'll bring 5, or we'll bring 10, or we'll bring 15. And that would be working together.
For me, it's just one of the most important films ever made. It's going to be in the top 25, maybe even higher, of movies if I'm putting together that kind of film spotting university list, the movies that I think are essential to understanding film and film history. I would put it in there with a handful of other documentaries, Harlan County, USA.
Yeah, I got to see that one. I've only seen one Kopple film, Miss Sharon Jones, which I liked quite a bit, but need to start back at the beginning.
Yeah, I've seen a few of them, including another documentary that kind of picks up where Harlan County left off in terms of another strike. And I can't believe I'm drawing a blank on the name of it. It has American in the title. It's from the 80s. Another wonderful doc from Barbara Kopple. Those are our top 5 female-directed debuts. We said we had a lot of options to choose from, a lot of films we regret that we haven't seen yet. Which do you feel like you need to mention before we go?
Yeah, I got to run through a handful. So Julia Ducournau's Raw has been talked about a lot on the show this year, a Golden Brick contender as well. So I felt like set that one aside. Similarly for Jennifer Kent's The Babadook, we mentioned that on our list of great horror debuts not too long ago. My homework, the one that I watched for the first time, was Nicole Holofcener's Walking and Talking. Never managed to get around to her first film, and really all the pieces were there for these exquisitely observed dramedies that she would go on to make. I really did enjoy it, almost put it on my list. Catherine Keener in there, never been better. And then real quickly here, Persepolis, co-directed by Marjane Satrapi. Of course, I have to mention Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides. You mentioned Lucretia Martel's La Cienega. And one that I almost forgot about, but Higher Ground from the actress Vera Farmiga. I don't know if she's done anything since, but I did like that film from a few years ago now.
Yeah, that was one that I really liked when it came out and we reviewed it on the show, and then actually liked it a little less when I made it part of my spiritual crises in cinema class a few summers ago. You covered some of my titles here, but I'm going to repeat a couple recent Brick nominees that I strongly considered: Diary of a Teenage Girl, Marielle Heller, The Edge of 17, Kelly Freeman Craig, two recent horror films, The Babadook, as you said, from Jennifer Kent, and A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, Anna Lily Amrapour. How about two Coppola films? Not only The Virgin Suicides, but Eleanor Coppola's Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, the documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now, pretty sure was Eleanor Coppola's first film. Some others I thought about Away From Her on your list. Baji on the Beach from Gurinder Chadha. Me and You and Everyone We Know from Miranda July. A New Leaf from your list. Red Road, Andrea Arnold's debut. And honestly, Lady Bird, if I'd seen it before I made my list, I definitely would have given it some serious thought. I'll go ahead and list my top five regrets too here real quick. The five movies, if I had more time, I would have absolutely seen before forming my list. Number one, Chocolat, Claire Denis, her version. Sweetie, from your list. Daughters of the Dust, from your list. Monster, the Patty Jenkins film. Have never seen that film that Charlize Theron won an Oscar for. And then one that came up from our listeners, Forest for the Trees, the debut film from Maren Atta, who did last year's Tony Erdmann. This is her debut film. So those titles and all the ones we've mentioned, along with at least 30 or 40 others, are all going to be on Letterboxd. I will post a link there. I'll list all of them. I'll keep it going. I'll add more as people share them with me. Want that to be kind of a master list, and I will link to that in our show notes as well at filmspotting.net.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of regrets, a number of listeners suggested Chantal Ackerman's first film, but there, that's just, we've talked about her for a marathon because I haven't seen anything.
Yeah, we're going to see Jean Dielman before we see her debut film at this point, I think. Again, those are our top five female-directed debuts. We would love to hear your picks or any other comments about the show. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also send us an MP3 file or leave us a short voicemail. We may just use it in an upcoming episode, 312-264-0744.
At filmspotting.net, you can find 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives all in the show archives. And while you're there, vote in the current Film Spotting poll. We're asking, have you seen Tommy Wiseau's The Room? And if you haven't already, check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show, and Film Spotting SVU. You can find them both in Apple Podcasts or through your preferred podcast app.
Out in wide release this weekend, the soggy, non-Josh Larson recommended Justice League. The star, a small but brave donkey, and his animal friends become the unsung heroes of the first Christmas. That sounds sweet. Wonder, an adaptation of the best-selling book about a boy with a facial deformity attending a mainstream elementary school for the first time. Owen Wilson and Julia Roberts star there, along with David Diggs. In limited release, BPM, that's Beats Per Minute. It was a Cannes Jury Prize winner set in Paris in the early 1990s. Mudbound, co-written and directed by Dee Reese of Pariah fame, a movie that got mentioned by many listeners as a great female-directed debut about a black and white family in the post-World War II South. Carey Mulligan and Garrett Hedlund star, along with Mary J. Blige. It's also playing on Netflix. And Martin McDonagh's latest, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Next week, we wish you a happy Thanksgiving. We're going to take a little bit of time off. We're going to revisit The Force Awakens, share some of your listener feedback, share our new thoughts upon seeing The Force Awakens again. So some new content there, but you'll also get a replay of our Rian Johnson interview from Film Spotting number 500 live.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Jeremy Wellhausen. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Like what you heard? Give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. That way we can reach new listeners. Our music this week is by First Aid Kit. Comes from the forthcoming album Ruins. More information is at firstaidkitband.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.